face, and his long fingers touched, then traced the curve of her cheek. He lowered his hand. When he spoke, his voice was so deep, so gravelly, she could only just make out the words,
"Get out of here, Antonia, now."
There was no real force behind the command, as if only a part of him meant it. Yet the unspoken warning was clear. The sense of standing on a precipice expanded and grew, and she chose the path of wisdom, of immediate safety. Despite her quaking limbs, she managed to, carefully, rise. It was an effort to wrench her gaze from his, but once she had, a curious defiance bloomed. Moving slowly, deliberately, she smoothed her skirt. Then she raised her head, looked directly into his shadowed eyes, less than a foot away, and despite being entirely unable to draw breath, coolly said, "Do let me know when you succeed in speaking with Ennis." He'd asked her for help with his mission several times, had availed himself of her social skills. She wasn't about to allow him to keep her in the dark over what was going on. As he would, if she let him. Boldly, she stepped past him. Her nerves leapt, as she sensed him tense and swivel as if to seize her. But he didn't. Exhaling silently, head high, she walked toward the door. "Good night." She opened the door and stepped outside. Without looking back into the unlit room, she started to draw the door closed behind her, and heard from within a dark murmur, "Good night." She shut the door, released the doorknob, then paused, for one instant, savoring the thrill of having played, just for a moment, with fire. Of having faced such a challenge, unknown and dangerous, at least to her, and survived the encounter. Then she realized a silly, far too smug for her own good smile, had curved her lips. She forced them straight, shook her head at her delusions. Dealing further with Sebastian was not going to be so easy, and walked slowly up the dim corridor. To reach the door to her room, she had to pass the archway to the gallery. As she did, from the corner of her eye, she glimpsed a dim figure lurking in the shadows on the other side of the archway. From the hairstyle, she instantly recognized Cecilia. Antonia gave no sign of having seen their hostess hovering in the dark. She reached her door, opened it, then paused and frowned. There'd been something about the way Cecilia had been standing, dithering. That was it. She'd intended to visit Sebastian, but had seen Antonia come out of his room and had drawn back, uncertain. Antonia glanced along the corridor. She didn't think Sebastian was expecting Cecilia. If he had been, he would have got rid of her much more quickly and with much less tension. Still, she waited and watched. After a minute or more had ticked past, her straining senses picked up the soft swish of silk skirts, but Cecilia didn't step into the corridor. Antonia debated, then quit her door and crept silently back to the archway. Peering into the gallery, she saw Cecilia retreating. Then Cecilia opened a door, went through, and shut the door behind her. Antonia drew back. Proprietorial satisfaction bloomed again. "Good," she murmured. Then she smiled and headed for her bed. Things had changed, or perhaps evolved, between her and Sebastian. She reacted as if he was hers, and he did the same over her. Well and good. As for the tension, the visceral connection that had erupted between them in the dark of his room, she wasn't entirely sure exactly what that presaged, but she was ready and distinctly eager to find out. Chapter 4. Sebastian bided his time through the morning, through an extended breakfast in the breakfast room. Then, as the day was once again fine, he followed the other guests outside. The younger lady set off for the folly from which they planned to sketch the views. After exchanging a coolly challenging glance with him, Antonia joined their ranks. Connell Boyne and his friends went out onto the rear lawn to smoke cheroots. After strolling the rear terrace and evaluating their options, the older men retreated to the library. Hadley Fanshawe and Sebastian trailed behind. Sebastian and Hadley settled in comfortable chairs at one end of the library. Ennis, Parrish, and McGibbon appeared to be discussing business of sorts at the other end. The table between Sebastian's and Hadley's chairs held a stack of gentlemen's sporting journals. They spent a quiet half hour flicking pages and trading the occasional remark. Then Filbury looked in. "Connell suggested a croquet tournament. Who's in?" As it transpired, all the men were gripped by competitive zeal. The entire male half of the company duly gathered on the croquet lawn, where Connell and Worthington had already set out the hoops. Mallets were passed around, and various structures for a tournament were discussed before a series of games was decided, and they settled to play in rotating groups of three. Knowing that playing croquet in groups was as much about arguing line and tactics, and that such a game never progressed quickly, but rather with long pauses for evaluation and dissection, Sebastian saw the perfect opportunity for speaking privately with Ennis looming. Although he had to wait for more than an hour, eventually he and Ennis were playing against each other, with Hadley as the third of their group. Hadley had proved a past master at taking forever to line up his shots. That left Sebastian and Ennis standing to one side of the green, watching. Sebastian waited until they were at one end of the oval-shaped course. After taking his shot, he walked to the edge of the clipped expanse to allow Hadley to essay his. Sebastian halted alongside Ennis, who shifted, as if to move away, but then, as if realizing how that would appear, settled again. "Indeed," Sebastian murmured, his gaze on Hadley. "I am most assuredly the last man you would want to see." He turned his head and met Ennis's widening eyes. "You?" Ennis looked stunned. Sebastian nodded and looked away.
"Winchelsea is a good friend."
He paused, then went on.
"I feel I should apologize for his inappropriate sense of humor. It was his idea to label me thus. But I realize, in the circumstances, the words might have led you to suppose his stand-in was someone else."
"Just so," Ennis sounded aggrieved. Sebastian glanced sharply at him.
"You haven't spoken of this to anyone else by mistake?"
"No, no." Ennis put a hand to his neckcloth, as if it was suddenly too tight. "Look here. I can't talk to you here. What I have to tell Winchelsea is too complicated to be conveyed in a few words." His gaze once more on Hadley's antics, Sebastian slowly nodded.
"Very well. When and where?"
"Tonight, in my study." Ennis paused, then added, "I'll meet you there at 10 o'clock.
"Yes."
Sebastian raised his voice.
"Look at that, straight through both hoops."
Walking to Hadley, Sebastian clapped him on the shoulder, then glanced at Ennis.
"Your turn."
They continued their game. Sebastian estimated his exchange with Ennis had taken no more than 2 minutes, if, as Ennis's nervousness suggested, someone of the company was connected with the plot Ennis intended to expose, even if that person had been watching them, there was no reason they would have imagined he and Ennis had discussed anything more enthralling than Hadley's game. The tournament eventually concluded, with Worthington declared the outright winner, with Hadley in second place. The younger ladies returned from the folly, and Cecilia, Mrs. Parrish, and Mrs. McGibbon returned from their exploration of the rose garden, just as Blanchard appeared on the rear terrace to strike the gong, summoning the party to luncheon. Antonia appeared by Sebastian's side and boldly wound her arm with his. He wasn't entirely certain he approved of the bolder, wilder side of her, certainly not when she allowed it out in public.
"So have you managed to corner Ennis?"
Her words floated to him on a whisper.
"Yes."
The others had started across the lawn to the terrace. He and she fell in at the rear of the company. He dipped his head and murmured.
"He elected to meet at 10 o'clock tonight in his study. He's definitely nervous of someone here."
If he is, that suggests that someone must have some sort of connection with whatever group Ennis intends to inform against, doesn't it?"
"So one would infer."
He paused, then said,
"While we're whiling away the day waiting for this meeting, we should see what more we can learn about the other Anglo-Irish here."
She nodded.
"You'll be largely restricted to the men. I'll see what I can extract from the women."
They joined the other guests in the dining room. As the seating at breakfast and luncheon was informal, and they were the last to reach the table, they perforce had to take the two remaining seats, the pair in the middle of the table on either side. That left Sebastian to entertain Miss Billhurst and Miss Boyne, while Antonia was left to the dubious delights of Worthington, still crowing about his croquet win, on one side, and Wilson on the other. As it happened, that suited Sebastian and Antonia. They diligently applied themselves to their joint undertaking, and the meal passed off more quickly and satisfactorily than either had expected. When the company rose, Antonia left Sebastian to his own devices and concentrated on cultivating Mrs. McGibbon, who was as Irish as her husband, unlike Mrs. Parrish, who was English through and through. But she quickly discovered that Mrs. McGibbon belonged to that class of wives who paid no attention whatsoever to the details of their husband's business. Beyond what she'd already imparted about McGibbon's interest in the local fishing fleet, she knew no more. She did not even know if her husband belonged to any particular club. Antonia shifted her sights to Melinda Boyne, and was pleased to discover that the younger woman had something of a tondra for filberry. Consequently, Melinda was a font of information on Filbury's background, friends and associates, and even more importantly, his views, and those of his close friends, on such matters as Irish independence. On the latter subject, Antonia had to reach deep and project an artlessness bordering on the inane. As the daughter of a very English earl, she had to phrase her questions exceedingly carefully, and as Melinda was by no means witless, pretend to a lack of comprehension that was profound, yet at the same time, believable. The careful interrogation took time and skill, and lasted until tea time. During the half hour spent over the cups in the drawing room, and the amble about the rose garden with her friends that followed, Antonia learned little else. Instead, she sifted through the numerous hints and facts Melinda had let fall. By the time the gong to dress for dinner sounded, she was ready to retire and refresh herself, body and mind, before participating in dinner and the musical evening Cecilia had arranged. She climbed the stairs with Claire and Georgia, Claire headed into the west wing, while Antonia and Georgia walked into the east wing to their rooms.
See you downstairs.
Georgia waved and went into her room. Antonia opened her door, walked inside, and saw Sebastian seated on the window seat. He didn't rise. Odd. Normally, inculcated manners would have brought him to his feet. Only in private, and only with a lady with whom he considered himself very close, such as a lover, would his instincts allow him to remain seated. Had he remained seated on purpose to send her some message, or had he not even noticed that he hadn't risen? One brow arching, she shut the door. A quick glance around informed her that Becky wasn't in the room.
Your maid was here. I sent her off and told her to wait for you to ring.
High-handed of you. Antonia didn't bother saying the words. She just threw him a haughty, disapproving look and walked to the dressing table. With a swish of her skirts, she subsided onto the stool.
So what have you learned?
She reached for the pins that held the bun at the back of her head in place. As she pulled the first free, she met Sebastian's eyes in the mirror. Yes, she was teasing him, challenging him, by letting down her hair like this, but too bad. Her wild side felt like it, and if he could arrogantly presume to send her maid away... She felt certain that, as in so many endeavours, he assumed that he would be in complete and absolute control of any relationship between them, that it would proceed and develop as he dictated. That certainty only prodded her into seeing how far she could push him, how far she could provoke him before he realized his assumption wasn't correct. A frisson of danger, of anticipation, fizzed through her veins. She pulled out the next pin. Sebastian felt he should, somehow, stop her unravelling her hair. The action created a far too intimate atmosphere. Yet he couldn't summon the necessary will to override his more primitive side. That part of him, the sensual, sexual being, wanted to see that crowning glory rippling over her shoulders. She'd been wearing her hair up for over a decade. He couldn't recall exactly what it had looked like when, as a girl, she'd worn it down. And it would be different now, lusher, thicker, more vibrant. Surreptitiously, he cleared his throat and ignored his ever-sharpening appetite.
From all I gathered from Worthington and Filbury, both of whom gossip far too readily, useful though that trait is, in this instance, I suspect Ennis has, at the very least tacitly, and possibly through donations, been a supporter of the young islander cause. However, despite possessing a large and well-established estate over there, he hasn't been back much in the past decade, and he certainly wasn't directly involved, any more than Parrish, McGibbon, or the younger men were, in the recent rebellion. Added to that, Cecilia is English to the bone, and according to Wilson, another likely young islander sympathizer, her influence is definitely anti-Irish.
So although Ennis might retain a sympathy for the Irish, it's sympathy at a distance, and overall, he settled into and is accepted by English society, and by all the evidence, he values that position.
Antonia continued easing pins from her tightly coiled hair and laying them on the dressing table.
I gathered from Mrs. Parrish and Mrs. McGibbon that the Ennises have lived here or at their townhouse in London consistently since their marriage.
He nodded.
I can see plenty of justification for Ennis if he'd heard of something beyond mere protests. For instance, of some plot that bordered on treason, feeling compelled to contact Drake.
As for whom among the guests he fears, I can't see why it would be Parrish or McGibbon,
although both live in Ireland, and therefore, presumably, have closer ties to those there. I get the sense they're exactly as they appear, gentlemen devoted to the managing of their estates and businesses, and having no special interest in any political intrigue.
I got the same impression from Miss Billhurst, although she's English. I gather she's been close to her aunt and uncle for most of her life, and has visited them frequently, and also from Melinda Boyne, who has known the Parrishes and McGibbons for years. Later, I overheard Cecilia talking to Mrs. Parrish and Mrs. McGibbon about their homes and children. Again, there was no whiff of anything that might remotely suggest any political interest at all, not on the ladies, or even on their husbands' parts.
Antonia let her coiled hair fall. The mass unfurled in a waterfall of wavy black tresses that spilled over her back, almost to her waist. Sebastian clenched both hands on the edge of the window seat, gripping against the impulse to rise and stroll to stand behind her, to where he could reach out and run his fingers through the silken fall of her hair. If fingers could slaver, at that moment, his did, hungry for the feel of black silk sliding across his palms and over and around his fingers. Antonia sighed, as if in physical relief, then raked her fingers under and back through her hair, lifting the long tresses, then letting them slither free. He tried to block the sight from his mind and forced himself to speak, although to his ears at least his tone was flat, devoid of enthusiasm.
Assuming that Ennis is indeed fearful of someone present at the house party, and not someone outside the company, then it seems we're looking at the younger men.
Antonia picked up her hairbrush.
Through my discussions with Worthington and Filbury at the luncheon table, and what Melinda Boyne, who's sweet on Filbury, let fall later, I gather both Worthington and Filbury are sympathetic to the cause, but neither go beyond good wishes. I seriously doubt either of them would be actively involved in any plot, but they might be informants to those who are.
She set the brush to her hair and started plying it, running down each long strand from her scalp to the wavy ends.
From what Cecilia let fall, she doesn't approve of any of the four. She tolerates Connell because he's Ennis's brother, and it's a family tradition that this house party is held to coincide with his annual visit to report to Ennis about the Irish harvest. Because Cecilia wanted to invite us, me, Melissa and Claire, as well as Georgia and Hadley, she needed to make up the numbers, so to keep peace with Ennis, she invited Filbury, Wilson and Worthington. She paused, busily brushing, then went on.
That said, Cecilia's attitude to the four younger men is dismissive rather than condemnatory, more because she doesn't consider them up to snuff socially than because she imagines they're up to no good.
The sight of her steadily, rhythmically running the brush through her hair was literally mesmerizing. After several seconds, Sebastian blinked, then dragged his eyes from the sight. He focused on the floor. After a moment, he frowned.
Ennis is anxious, even fearful of someone. But it's possible the reason for that has nothing to do with his message for Drake.
Another coincidence?
He looked up and in the mirror met her eyes, took in her cynically disbelieving expression. He felt his jaw set.
Quite.
He hesitated, then took the bit between his teeth and did what he'd come there to do.
Tonight, after dinner, don't go anywhere near Ennis, especially don't go near his study.
In the glass she held his gaze, then she arched a coolly imperious brow.
I promise I'll come and tell you what he says afterward.
He told her of the meeting and would tell her of its outcome for one simple reason. It was senseless to keep such information a complete secret, to have no one but himself knowing, not when she was there, knew Drake, and understood the mission, and he knew he could trust her. She studied him, searched his face, for several seconds. Then she nodded.
Very well. Just as long as you tell me later.
That had gone better than he'd hoped. He hadn't been sure how she would react to what she might well have interpreted as an attempt to rein her in. The warning was an attempt to keep her away from any potential action. While talking to Ennis should, theoretically, be safe enough, Sebastian's thumbs were pricking. He didn't like not knowing the source of Ennis's underlying fear. But he'd accomplished what he'd come there to do. He'd learned what she'd found out about the other guests and had ensured she would keep her distance that evening. His gaze had drifted and was once more transfixed on her brush, travelling languidly through the thick fall of her hair. He inwardly shook himself free of the distraction and rose.
"I'll see you in the drawing room."
She met his gaze, then pointed to the bell pull.
"You can ring for Becky before you leave."
He hid a grin at her tone. She hadn't liked him dismissing her maid. So he dutifully tugged the bell pull, then opened the door and slipped out, closing the door quietly behind him. Antonia paused in her brushing and stared at the closed door for several seconds. Ennis was frightened of someone or something. Frightened people were unpredictable. Then again, she'd never known Sebastian not to be able to take care of himself. Turning back to the mirror, she set down her brush and reached up to remove her earrings. At 2:58 that evening, Sebastian pushed away from the balustrade at the east end of the terrace that ran along the front of the house and ambled back toward the front door. Half an hour earlier, after they'd finished with the port and brandy, Ennis had been the first to rise from the dining table. He'd excused himself on the grounds of having some urgent estate matter to deal with, and had gone off, presumably to his study. After a day spent in each other's company, the guests had grown more relaxed with each other. The other men had drifted from the table in twos and threes. Sebastian had retreated to the front terrace, deserted at that time, to avoid being roped into another billiards game, or some conversation. He didn't want to have to make his excuses at 10:00, thereby calling attention to a meeting. He opened the heavy front door, stepped inside, and let the door quietly close behind him. His shoes made little sound as he walked slowly down the long front hall. He halted just short of the archway giving onto the corridor leading to Ennis's study. Earlier, he'd asked a footman where it was. From the sound of feminine voices and the tinkling of a piano, it seemed the ladies had remained in the music room, whither they'd retreated on rising from the table. The green baize-covered door at the rear of the hall swung open, and Blanchard appeared, pushing the tea trolley. He saw Sebastian and inclined his head, then turned the trolley toward the music room. Sebastian stirred and walked forward. He turned into the corridor leading toward the study, just as, with a series of whirs and muted clangs, the clocks in the house geared up for the hour, then bonged and chimed in unison. As the 10th bong resonated through the house, he reached the intersection where the corridor he was in met another to the left. The intersecting corridor led to Ennis's study, and ultimately to the billiards room. The door to the study lay 3 paces along the corridor. Somewhat to Sebastian's surprise, the door stood slightly ajar. He halted outside the door and rapped on the panel. He heard nothing from inside. No sound at all bar the clink of billiard balls coming from the end of the corridor. Increasingly wary, he pushed the study door further open. Ennis's desk, a large polished mahogany affair, stood at one side of the room, set square and facing across the width, with the chair behind pushed back against a wall of shelves. Sebastian stepped over the threshold and looked around the door. But there was no one sitting in the armchairs, angled before the hearth. A fire crackled cheerily in the grate. On the opposite side of the room, the lamp on Ennis's desk was lit, shedding a steady glow over several letters and papers left strewn across the blotter, as if Ennis had been there, but had just stepped out. Then a gust of cooler air drew Sebastian's gaze to the long window directly opposite the door. The curtains were pushed aside, and the sash was raised. Curious, given it was cold and misty outside. Sebastian hesitated, yet it was 10 o'clock. He reached back, returned the door to its almost closed position, then strolled toward the desk and put out a hand to draw back one of the pair of chairs angled before it. The chair behind the desk was pushed hard, jammed, against the shelves, almost as if... Swallowing an oath, Sebastian strode around the desk and looked down at Lord Ennis. Ennis was lying on his back, one arm outflung, his other hand pressed to a wound on his left side from which blood was steadily pouring. Sebastian leapt to the bell pull and yanked hard 3 times. Then he lifted the heavy chair, set it aside, and crouched in its place beside Ennis. Even from his first rushed glance, Sebastian knew Ennis was done for. His lordship's eyes were closed, but this close, Sebastian could just hear the man's shallow breathing. "Ennis, who did this?" Surely the most important question. At the sound of his voice, Ennis rallied. He opened his eyes, then fractionally shook his head. He shifted his outflung arm, raised that hand, and gripped Sebastian's wrist. Ennis tensed, plainly fighting for breath. Sebastian leaned nearer. Ennis's mouth worked, his lips moved.
"Gunpowder."
The word was a thready gasp. Ennis gripped Sebastian's wrist, as if to draw strength from him, and forced out,
"Here."
The effort was too much. Ennis's eyes lost focus, then his lids fell, and all tension left his body. At the last, his fingers relaxed, and his hand fell limply from Sebastian's wrist to the floor. Sebastian closed his eyes. He hung his head for a moment, then slowly, he rose. A sudden rush of footsteps sounded in the corridor. Blanchard pushed the door wide and raced in. He saw Sebastian and pulled up short. "My lord!" Blanchard glanced around, clearly expecting to see his master. His face, like stone, Sebastian gestured to the figure at his feet.
"I was to meet with Lord Ennis at 10 o'clock. I arrived to find the door ajar and your master..."
Sebastian looked at the body on the floor. Blanchard came around the desk. The butler's eyes grew huge.
"Oh, my good lord!"
"Indeed. I found his lordship lying there dead, murdered."
Sebastian glanced at Blanchard, who was now chalk white.
"Who was the local magistrate?"
Without looking away from the body, Blanchard answered,
"Sir Humphrey Rattle, my lord."
Sebastian drew in a not quite steady breath.
"I suggest you leave a footman on guard in this room. Put another at the door to keep everyone away. And send for Sir Humphrey immediately."
Blanchard drew in a deep breath and straightened. He nodded.
"Indeed, my lord."
Then Blanchard looked suspiciously at Sebastian.
"And you, my lord?"
"I?"
said Sebastian most unwillingly.
"We'll break the news to the others."
He thought, then added,
"Please summon everyone to the drawing room. I'm sure Sir Humphrey will prefer us all to be together, in one place, when he arrives."
Chapter 5. Shock was never a pleasant experience. Sebastian had seen dead men, even murdered men, before. He'd killed three himself in the furtherance of one or other of Drake's missions. But they'd been villains, and not men he knew. Finding Ennis dying, stabbed in his own study, had been an experience of a different caliber. Despite having drunk a cup of tea followed by a large brandy, he still felt chilled, and was grateful for Antonia's soft warmth close beside him as they sat on one of the smaller sofas in the drawing room. The members of the house party had dutifully congregated, summoned by Blanchard and the footman with the message that there was some serious news Sebastian had to impart to them. Once they'd all been assembled, he told them of Ennis's death. For Cecilia's sake, he'd been as gentle and as vague as possible. Cecilia now sat huddled between Mrs. Parrish and Mrs. McGibbon, weeping quietly. Sebastian judged her to be shocked and truly grieving. He could see no reason for Cecilia to have murdered her husband. Despite her affairs, and Ennis's, they'd been sincerely attached in the way of couples who rub along well enough together, and who had made a life, and had children together. Although desire might have waned, affection had remained. The other guests sat in small groups around the room. Most still looked stunned. He told them the magistrate had been sent for, and that it would be best for them to await Sir Humphrey's arrival, rather than retire. Blanchard had advised that Sir Humphrey lived less than 15 minutes away, and would most likely ride to the hall. Over the soft sound of Cecilia's weeping, the guests exchanged comments in hushed tones. Sebastian scanned the faces, wondering which of them, if any, was the murderer. Despite the apparent message of the open window, he was disinclined to believe that the murderer came from outside the house, not with the way Ennis had been behaving. Someone presently under Ennis's roof had murdered his lordship. Why wasn't quite so clear. Sebastian glanced at Antonia. Other than an initial, "Oh no," she'd said nothing, just sat beside him and offered wordless support. He studied her face. Her complexion was paler than usual, but her eyes were clear as they moved from face to face around the company. He reached out and took her hand. Immediately she glanced at him, but didn't draw her fingers from his. He lifted her hand across so that he could cradle it between both of his. Just the simple fact of feeling her fingers under his soothed some part of him and cleared some of the fog from his mind. Looking at the other guests again, under his breath, he murmured, "I need you to do something for me." "But," she murmured back, instantly, without the slightest hesitation. He would have grinned if the matter wasn't so serious. "Should anything occur to delay me, like the magistrate insisting on taking me off somewhere for questioning, I need you to return to London and tell Drake, or if he's not back, then his masters in Whitehall, what Ennis said." There was a second silence, then she breathed,
"What he said?"
Until then, he hadn't mentioned Ennis's last words, not to anyone. "When I found him," he continued, his words a bare whisper, "he was still alive. I asked who had stabbed him, but instead of answering that, he used the last of his strength to say two words. Gunpowder, here." She too appeared to be looking idly across the room. She stiffened, then drew a slow, shallow breath and murmured,
"Good Lord."
Indeed, he clearly believed those two words were more important
than naming his murderer. Antonia shifted her hand in his hold and gripped his fingers as he was gripping hers. Her mind darted this way, then that, evaluating, imagining. Despite the scarifying implication of Ennis's last words, she didn't like the notion of leaving Sebastian to his fate. But he was a marquess, and perfectly capable of acting as one of the higher nobility, and pulling rank when he chose to do so. She felt confident he wouldn't be taken up, but she could understand that, to him, having her agreement that, in such an eventuality, she would take Ennis's words back to Drake was important. She forced herself to nod.
All right. If anything happens to detain you, I'll take the message to London.
And then, if he had indeed been detained, she would come straight back, dragging Drake, or St. Ives, or even her own father with her to ensure Sebastian was immediately released. Unaware of her full intention, he squeezed her fingers in wordless thanks. Instinctively, she returned the comforting pressure. Then they heard voices outside. He released her hand, and she drew it back. Along with the other guests, they looked expectantly toward the drawing-room door. But the sound of heavy footsteps marched past, and the door did not open.
The magistrate will have gone to examine the body, Sebastian stated, his gaze resting on Cecilia, who gulped and tried valiantly to contain her sobs.
5 minutes later, they again heard footsteps approaching. This time, the door opened to admit a robust gentleman of above middle years, yet still hale and hearty. His face looked the sort that would normally be graced with a genial expression. But tonight, Sir Humphrey Rattle looked grave. After one swift survey of the room, with a brisk gesture, Sir Humphrey directed a constable to wait unobtrusively beside the door. Then he walked forward and bowed before Cecilia, who, with an effort, managed to give him her hand.
"Dreadful business, my dear."
Sir Humphrey patted Cecilia's hand, then released it.
"You stay where you are. I'm sure your guests and I can introduce ourselves."
Sir Humphrey proceeded to circle the room. He didn't shake hands, but attentively noted every name, asking the obvious questions that allowed him to link this one with that. As he moved on, the gentleman, who had risen at his approach, remained standing. Eventually, Sir Humphrey reached Sebastian, who, like the others, rose to face him.
"Erith,"
Sebastian said,
"I'm here as escort to Lady Antonia Rawlings."
He waited while Antonia gave Sir Humphrey her hand, and the magistrate bowed over it. As Sir Humphrey straightened, Sebastian said,
"It was I who found the body."
Sir Humphrey eyed him shrewdly.
"You did, eh?"
After a second of studying him, Sir Humphrey turned to face the room.
"I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen, that due to the serious nature of this crime, I am obliged to report the matter to Scotland Yard. I've already sent off a courier to notify the Yard, and I expect we'll see an inspector here by tomorrow morning. Until then, you will all need to remain at Pressingstoke Hall. As I gather the house party has only just commenced, that shouldn't create any difficulties for any of you."
Sir Humphrey paused, as if waiting for a protest that didn't come. He cast a sidelong glance at Sebastian, then said,
"Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you would oblige me by waiting here for the next few minutes, I'll have a quick chat with Lord Erith, and then decide what's best to be done."
"It was Sinister, Erith, who found Ennis."
Worthington looked unnaturally pale.
"None of the rest of us even went near. The butler and the footman kept us away. Can't see what good keeping us cooped up here will do."
"Nevertheless," Sir Humphrey said, and now there was steel in his tone, "for the moment, I require you to remain in this room. My chat with Lord Erith will not take long.
With that, Sir Humphrey directed an inquiring look Sebastian's way, and with a tip of his head, indicated the door. Sebastian fell in beside the magistrate. As they neared the door, Sir Humphrey, his head lowered and his hands clasped behind his back, murmured,
"You're St. Ives's son, aren't you?"
"Yes. The Marquis of Irith is a courtesy title."
"I see."
Sir Humphrey opened the drawing-room door and waved Sebastian ahead of him. After closing the door behind them, Sir Humphrey said,
"I'll get Blanchard to find us a room, and you can tell me..."
"Actually..."
Sebastian halted in the middle of the hall, and looking back, met Sir Humphrey's eyes.
"Might I suggest we speak outside?"
"Outside?"
Sir Humphrey frowned. Sebastian gestured to the front door.
"There is a reason for my request."
"If you would humour me." Sir Humphrey debated for all of 1 second. He couldn't gainsay a man of Sebastian's lofty rank, not without having a very good reason. He nodded curtly.
"Very well."
Sebastian led the way to the door. A footman sprang to open it. Walking onto the front porch, Sebastian noted a constable standing in the shadows along the front terrace. Looking ahead, he pointed to the circle of open lawn beyond the sweep of the drive.
"There should do."
He started down the steps, making it clear he expected Sir Humphrey to follow. Sebastian crossed the gravel drive and walked on until he was several yards beyond its edge. Then he halted and waited for Sir Humphrey to join him. The magistrate stopped and faced him, regarding him through narrowed eyes.
"What's the reason for this, eh?"
Sebastian met his gaze.
"I want to be 100% certain that what I say to you will not be overheard."
Sir Humphrey blinked. Before the magistrate could pose another question, Sebastian asked,
"Have you heard of Winchelsea, of the role he plays?"
Sir Humphrey's expression grew wary.
"You mean Wolverstone's heir? Another marquis like you?"
Sebastian nodded.
"Just so. But the important point is whether or not you know what Winchelsea does."
Sir Humphrey studied Sebastian for a moment, then grudgingly admitted,
"I've heard he works for the Home Secretary in some secretive sort of capacity."
"Indeed."
Sebastian judged he had to take the chance and tell Sir Humphrey of the mission.
"What I'm about to tell you must be held in the strictest confidence. I'm attending this house party, ostensibly squiring Lady Antonia, who is a family friend, both of my family
and also of Winchelsea's.
In reality, I'm here in Drake's,
Winchelsea's,
stead. He sent me here to act as his surrogate and receive a message from Lord Ennis."
"A message?"
"Ennis wrote that he had information of vital significance to lay before Winchelsea, but that he would not commit that information to writing. Instead,
he wanted to meet Winchelsea face to face and suggested he attend this house party for that purpose.
Unfortunately,
Winchelsea had a pressing engagement elsewhere, in Ireland, as it happens.
Consequently, he was very interested in hearing what Ennis had to say, but couldn't be in two places at the same time.
I've occasionally assisted Winchelsea before, so he asked me to stand in for him and come to the house party."
"And we arranged for me to attend as Lady Antonia's escort. My brief was to contact Ennis and receive whatever information his lordship wished to divulge."
"I see."
Sir Humphrey frowned. He stared at the trees bordering the lawn.
"So what happened? Did you get the information?"
"Yes and no. I only managed to speak privately with Ennis this morning,
when I alerted him to the fact that I was Winchelsea's surrogate.
We couldn't talk further then. We were in the middle of a game of croquet. Ennis suggested we should meet tonight at 10 o'clock in his study, the implication being
that he would give me the information for Winchelsea then.
I arrived outside the study door just after the clock struck 10 and found the door ajar. I went in and, subsequently, found Ennis stabbed and dying. You saw where the body was.
Dying? Under his bushy brows, Sir Humphrey's eyes flew wide.
Blanchard said Ennis was already dead when you found him.
He wasn't, but I let everyone assume he was.
So did he say anything?
After summoning the staff, before they arrived, I asked Ennis who had stabbed him. He shook his head, and instead of answering, used his last breaths to say two words. Gunpowder. Here.
Sebastian heard the grimness in his tone.
Then he died.
Gunpowder? Here?
Sir Humphrey all but goggled. Indeed. And no, I have no idea what that actually means.
The night's cold silence engulfed them. From deep in the wood to the side of the house came the hoot of an owl. Sir Humphrey shifted. Then he cleared his throat and gruffly said,
"No insult intended, my lord, but do you have any proof of this business?"
Sebastian stirred. He reached into the inside pocket of his coat.
"I have the letter from Ennis to Winchelsea. You'll be able to verify it's Ennis's handwriting, and a copy of Winchelsea's reply."
He offered the folded sheets to the magistrate. Sir Humphrey took the letters, walked back to stand beside one of the lanterns lighting the edge of the drive, and silently read both. Sebastian followed. Facing the house, he halted beside the magistrate and waited. Then Sir Humphrey frowned and shot him a look from under his shaggy brows.
"Why call you the last man Ennis would want to see?"
Sebastian sighed. That was Drake's misplaced sense of humour. 6 years ago, Lady Ennis and I were, for a short time, lovers. Ennis was aware of that. Hence, Drake surmised, I was not a man Ennis would want to see.
Ah!
Sir Humphrey glanced again at the signatures on the letters, then refolded them and handed them back.
I rather think those are proof enough. I know Ennis's signature. This sounds like a serious business, and clearly you wouldn't have killed Ennis when he was the source of the information you and your friend Winchelsea wanted.
Just so.
Sebastian tucked the letters back into his pocket.
It's possible that Ennis was killed to prevent him passing on the information. Alternatively, he might have been killed for some other reason entirely. At this point, there's no way to tell.
You'll have to show those letters to the inspector when he arrives.
Sir Humphrey grimaced.
Reading between the lines, I take it the Irish are involved?
Sebastian admitted.
We're assuming we're dealing with some offshoot of the Young Irelander movement. I suspect Ennis was a sympathizer, but most in the movement would see the use of gunpowder as a step too far.
Indeed. Sir Humphrey tugged one earlobe and frowned at the lawn. After several moments, he said,
"So how do you think we should proceed?"
"Until the murderer is caught, I would caution against allowing anyone, English or Anglo-Irish, to leave. As you mentioned, all the guests had expected to be here until Thursday, so there's no reason they can't remain until then, at least."
"Oh, we'll definitely keep everyone here. The inspector should arrive in the morning, and we can decide what's next then."
Sir Humphrey turned toward the house.
"I'd best get back to the others. I have a few questions. Then I'll tell everyone they can find their beds. I'll leave constables on guard to make sure no one bolts."
Sebastian fell into step beside Sir Humphrey. As they crossed the forecourt, he said,
"One thing, if you would. Please instruct your constables to allow myself and Lady Antonia to ride out tomorrow. There's a gentleman who lives nearby who might be able to shed some light on whatever plot Ennis had got wind of,
especially given Ennis's here. If there's some local connection, this gentleman might know more of it. As Winchelsea is almost certainly still in Ireland, there's no sense in me rushing to get Ennis's two words back to London. It would be more profitable for me to see what I can find out at this end, and to wait to see if you and the inspector can identify the murderer. Sir Humphrey nodded. They reached the porch, and he halted and beckoned the constable who'd been standing unobtrusively against the house's front wall.
"Sergeant Crickwell," Sir Humphrey waved at Sebastian. "This is the Marquess of Erith. He and a lady, Lady Antonia Rawlings, have permission to ride out as they wish. Everyone else, however, staff as well as her ladyship and the guests, are to remain at the house. They can walk the lawns, but for the moment, no farther."
"Yes, sir. I'll pass the word."
Sergeant Crickwell nodded and stepped back into the shadows. Blanchard had heard their voices. He opened the front door before they reached it. Sebastian walked beside Sir Humphrey into the house. Blanchard closed the door and followed. He anticipated their direction and moved to stand by the drawing-room door. Frowning, Sir Humphrey halted and turned to Sebastian.
"A man, don't you think?" he murmured.
Sebastian considered, then said, "Most likely, but not necessarily. Whoever stabbed Ennis, he had to have known them to allow them to get that close." He saw the scene in his mind, imagined how it would have played out. "As I recall, there was one clean strike, angled upward, to hit the heart. I didn't see any signs of a scuffle, did you?"
"No,"
Sir Humphrey grunted. "And I suppose you're right. With a sufficiently sharp weapon, a woman could have delivered that blow."
"I believe," Sebastian said, "that from the time they quit the dining table, all the ladies were together in the music room. If so, they can vouch for each other."
"Excellent. We'd best get that out of the way first."
Blanchard was hovering, his gaze flicking from Sebastian to Sir Humphrey, presumably seeking some hint of Sir Humphrey's stance on Sebastian's possible guilt. Sir Humphrey noticed. He humphed and gave Blanchard the same instructions he'd given Crickwell.
"No one at all to depart, mind, and that includes all the staff, although his lordship here and Lady Antonia are free to come and go."
"We will, however, be remaining as part of the house party," Sebastian clarified.
Blanchard inclined his head. To Sir Humphrey he said,
"The murder has shaken the staff, sir, as one might expect. If there's any reassurance I might convey..."
Sir Humphrey sighed.
"At this moment, Blanchard, there's nothing I can say that would reassure anyone."
He nodded toward the drawing room.
"I'm going to ask a few more questions, then allow everyone to retire for the night. I'll leave constables on watch, inside and outside the house. That should calm any imminent hysteria. I expect to be back tomorrow morning with the inspector Scotland Yard will send down. You might ask among the staff if anyone saw or heard anything that might be relevant. For instance, whether anyone unexpected was seen leaving the house around 10 o'clock.
Blanchard bowed.
"Very good, sir. I will inquire."
He moved to open the drawing-room door. Sir Humphrey led the way in. Sebastian followed. As the door closed behind him, he surveyed the company spread around the room. Everyone had looked up, but most gazes flitted over him and fixed on Sir Humphrey as the magistrate walked forward. Only Antonia continued looking at Sebastian, incipient concern in her eyes. He met her gaze, infinitesimally shook his head, and strolled to reclaim his position on the sofa beside her. Sir Humphrey, meanwhile, took up a stance at the end of the rug, directly opposite the fireplace, and faced the assembled company.
"Now, if you will bear with me, I have a few simple questions, and then you may retire. I understand that on rising from the dinner table, the ladies gathered in the music room, which from memory is toward the rear corner of the ground floor, beyond the breakfast room. At what time did you rise from the dinner table? The ladies exchanged glances. Then Cecilia mumbled something around the handkerchief pressed to her lips, and Mrs. Parrish beside her spoke up.
It was about 9:20.
A murmur of agreement came from various female throats, and some of the men nodded as well.
Excellent. So the ladies gathered in the music room. Did you all go there directly?
I believe so.
Mrs. Parrish looked at the other ladies for confirmation. Antonia's clear voice cut across the resulting chatter.
Miss Wainwright and I were the last of the ladies to reach the music room. As I recollect, all the other ladies walked ahead of us, and all of us went directly into the music room.
Melissa Wainwright nodded.
That's correct. We brought up the rear, and all the others were ahead of us. No one went anywhere else.
And you all remained in the music room until the murder was discovered?
Yes, and definitely,
came from all sides. Then Miss Billhurst said,
I was at the piano for most of the time, until we heard the alarm. I was playing, and from the stool I could see all the ladies and the door. No one was rude enough to leave, I noticed. Everyone was still there when we heard.
She waved vaguely.
Thank you.
Satisfied, Sir Humphrey cast his gaze over the gentleman.
So the ladies left at 9:20. I assume the gentleman remained to pass the decanters?
Most of the men nodded. Sebastian stated,
As I recall, all the gentlemen remained in the dining room, at the table, for only a relatively short time. About 10 minutes after the ladies left, Ennis excused himself on the grounds of having some pressing matter of business to deal with.
Sir Humphrey glanced around, and a number of men murmured agreement.
So, Sir Humphrey concluded, the critical question for all the gentlemen will be where each of you were between 9:30 and 10:00, when Lord Irith found Ennis dead.
There was silence for a moment, then Mrs. McGibbon exclaimed,
Great heavens, sir! You can't possibly think that any of those here stabbed his lordship.
She sounded faintly incredulous and genuinely shocked.
I gather the study window was open, Hadley Fanshawe said. Surely Ennis came upon some vagrant, rifling his desk, and the miscreant stabbed him and escaped.
Sir Humphrey inclined his head.
We are pursuing that notion.
Good Lord!
Mrs. Parrish had paled.
A murdering vagrant on the loose. Why, any of us might be murdered in our beds.
Antonia uttered a muted but plainly derisive sound. With his hands, Sir Humphrey gestured for calm.
There's no cause for panic. I will be leaving constables on watch inside the house and around about. You needn't fear any villain will get in. However, I must insist that, until the inspector arrives and gives you leave, you must all remain.